IEEE Soundings recently went to Philadelphia to bring you excerpts of a technological and economic assessment of the future of solid-state technology as presented by a panel of distinguished experts assembled at the 1972 IEEE International Solid-State Circuits Conference. The panelists were Richard L. Petritz of New Business Resources Incorporated, Dallas, Texas, J. Fred Busey, Texas Instruments, Dallas, Texas, John Welty, Motorola Semiconductor Products, Phoenix, Arizona, and R.N. Noyce of Intel Corporation, Mountain View, California. And now on to our speakers. The discussion begins with Dick Petritz and Fred Busey.
Beginning back in the spring of 1969, the electronics industry began an economic decline that was not just an aerospace phenomena, but involved the computer industry, consumers. The overall indices of electronic activity began to decline, and we do see some evidence today of a bottoming out of that decline, but there are serious questions in the minds of many of us as to the overall vitality of the industry, in particular the outlook for the semiconductor solid-state aspect of the industry, both from a business point of view, which ultimately must reflect back into the engineer's outlook. Our speakers are particularly well qualified to participate in this program, and from both the technical as well as the business side, it turns out that all three of them have bachelor's degrees in physics and graduate degrees in physics. They all have begun their technical career in research laboratories and have risen into important managerial positions, but they do have a strong research and development background. Our first speaker is Mr. J. Fred Busey of Texas Instruments. He's a group vice president of TI and is responsible for their entire components, including the semiconductor activity.
Now, since its inception, the Solid State Conference has enjoyed the highest reputation as a convocation of the world's outstanding solid-state engineers and scientists. Traditionally, the conference had been confined to technology alone. But today's panel breaks with that tradition because I think we recognize that technology alone is no longer enough. Technology, for the sake of technology, will not solve the problems of the semiconductor industry. It can only aggravate our problems. The growth of the SC technology will be stunted unless we extend the boundaries of the markets that use semiconductor technology. We can ill afford scientists and engineers that sit back passively, awaiting to solve problems that are brought to them. If we are to have a dynamic industry in the 70s, our technologists must seize the initiative in identifying the many problems electronics can solve through the use of modern solid-state technology. We must discharge the responsibility for stimulating our own industry. We must not wait for another Sputnik to reawaken the American public. And so it is most appropriate that we stop to analyze the positions of electronics and semiconductor industries and achieve some consensus as to the goals that we must achieve in the coming decade. Now, we must start in the direction of the optimum market growth. Once we commit to the essential goal of dynamic growth, we must then gain the commitment of resources and energy necessary to break down the remaining barriers of the widespread expansion of electronics. Now, we have more than enough collective imagination and courage to make this industry succeed. But if we don't use our rich human resources around the world to create the pervasive electronics worldwide markets, then the semiconductor industry will go down in history as one of being an unfulfilled promise. Now, what is the first step? In his excellent book, John Gardner says, a mature society must make a particular effort to reward its innovators because its very nature discourages innovation. Electronics is obviously not a mature industry, except in one very important regard. Our share of the gross national product has not grown during the last few years. And I must consider this a warning symptom of impending maturity. Now, broadly speaking, maturity does discourage innovation. Money goes where the action is. Without strong economic growth, or at least the anticipation of it in the semiconductor industry, no company will long risk the resources necessary to encourage innovation in a stagnant field. Therefore, we must keep alive the promise of future growth equal to or near our historical growth of the past decade. Those of us who have lived through previous recessions in electronics might conclude that the great with great confidence that our former history of rapid recovery will repeat itself automatically. We might even conclude that our traditional 7.5% U.S. growth rate will restore itself out of sheer momentum. Now, while you might argue successfully that the decline electronics has experienced in the U.S. during the last 3 or 4 years is not really as serious as the figures indicate, I don't think anyone would claim that we are increasing our penetration in the total economy. If, as I suspect, electronics is not even maintaining its share of the GNP, then we may have ended our growth phase and entered maturity. Regardless of our certain absolute growth in physical volume. Now, unless you and I take some dramatic steps to renew the dynamic economic growth of electronics, it will be a maturity that neither the industry nor you or I is going to enjoy. Now, is increase in the penetration of GNP a valid measure of maturity? Agricultural and electrical industries provide examples of industries that are economically mature today. No longer do they offer expanding employment opportunities. No longer do they present opportunities for rapid personal advancement. And no longer are they investing a large enough share of the resources in research and development to promote dynamic growth. In short, these are mature industries, and they are not the kind that you or I have chosen to work in. Nor do we, as technologists, think of them as environments of personal opportunity. Nor are there environments in which we can make major contributions to the welfare of mankind. Now, incidentally, the agricultural and electrical industries have consistently achieved outstanding increases in efficiency year after year. Now, this raises the question, does our economic system reward efficiency? It appears that our system offers handsome rewards to problem solvers, independent of efficiency or technology. But this raises questions worthy of many other panels like this one, so I'm not going to pursue it at this time. Now, how does penetration of GNP by electronics look in other parts of the world? At the risk of crying wolf and sounding the electronics gap alarm, I must point out that the U.S. continues to be outstripped in electronics growth. You may argue why the U.S. is different and why the absolute values shown here may not be exact, but that's beside the point. It is the relative slopes that are significant. Japan's consumer market is the size of the U.S. Their total non-military market is more than half the size of the U.S. And of course, they dwarf us as electronics exporters. Japan's success is not due to low labor rates, but rather to outstanding engineering and imagination which matches solid-state technology to the consumer's pocketbooks. Let's face it. The Japanese are out-engineering the rest of the world in the field of applying solid-state products to consumer products. I have the greatest respect for these worthy competitors. But must we continually lose whole segments of our markets to them due to our own lack of imagination? Now, in semiconductor innovation alone, is semiconductor innovation enough to maintain the high growth rate for electronics? The semiconductor industry is not technologically stagnant. A part of the problem of achieving continued growth through innovation is due to our new technologies obsoleting older technologies. This 100% chart shows the discrete semiconductors had taken over half of the circuit functions from receiving tubes by 1964. In turn, integrated circuits took over more than half of the circuit functions around 1970. In like manner, medium and large-scale integration promises to have taken over more than half of all the functions by some time this year or next. Now, the semiconductor manufacturer thus support research and development across a broad front. As the Red Queen said to Alice in Wonderland, you must run as fast as you can just to be able to stay in one place. Now, in today's world of electronics, regardless of how superb a technical innovation may be, it can take several years to realize a profit. And to make matters worse, in too many cases, after a few profitable years, regardless of how much value to the user we have put into the product, rewards to the semiconductor manufacturer can remain modest. For example, integrated circuits were available commercially in 1960. It was 7 years before they began to make significant contributions to industry billings. And although the number of circuit functions performed by integrated circuitry continues to increase at a high rate, the dollar industry income for integrated circuits has increased only slightly during the past few years, despite a rapid increase in circuit functions served. This is a tribute to our success in achieving our higher complexities and outstanding productivity. But we have not generated dollars to match these advances. Moreover, throughout most of the life of integrated circuitry, the integrated circuit industries, the semiconductor industry's ability to supply low-cost circuits in high volume has far exceeded the ability of the U.S. electronic equipment builders to use them. Now, what has this experience done to the funding of technology? This pattern has given rise to three major inhibitors in the minds of management considering the funding of new semiconductor technology. We are haunted by our experience. First, the innovation seldom generates significant dollars during the first few years of their commercial availability. Second, that the dollars they generate are not keeping pace with the value of the expanding functions they perform. And third, that the traditional electronic equipment industry alone, particularly in the U.S., lacks the capacity to absorb units fast enough to support our former growth rate. We must find ways to overcome and bypass these barriers. Now, what do all these factors have to do with technology development? The answer, of course, is that the resource of allocations, development funding, depends upon management's guess of growth rate. If it is believed that the semiconductor industry will resume its historic strong growth, the funding for new technologies will be generous. But if the anticipation is that the semiconductor industry will grow no faster than the economy as a whole, development funding will be relatively meager. The problem is that management's prophecy can be self-fulfilling because of its power to fund or not fund. I've shown the process here as a feedback loop to remind you how commercially successful technology feeds on itself. The semiconductor industry must outgrow its puppy love infatuation for glamorous new technologies that won't expand our markets. We must concentrate our technology on solving problems that need solving, which at the same time promote the pervasiveness of electronics. Now, why is pervasiveness of electronics necessary? It is necessary if we are to enlarge our markets at a rate that can match our desired growth. We refer to all the old-line electronic equipment manufacturers as the traditional industry. If the semiconductor industry is to be limited to serving only this traditional industry, during the coming decade, we will grow slowly indeed. We feel that the 5.7% growth rate is realistic, and that the 7.1% rate is optimistic if we confine ourselves to the traditional markets. We expect the world market to grow faster, largely because they include undeveloped markets for equipment, while the U.S. market is more of a replacement market for equipment. For example, most large computers sold in the U.S. replace older computers. Outside the U.S., many are sold for the first time to users. We cannot depend upon the traditional electronics industry to support the growth or desired growth of a semiconductor industry. Given our history of steadily increasing productivity with more circuit functions per dollar, the kind of growth you see here might support no more than a few percent per year dollar growth in semiconductors. My point is, we must go far beyond the confines of traditional electronics equipment to find the broad basis which will support the dynamic growth of our semiconductor industry needs. Now, fortunately, solid-state electronics is so versatile, so broadly capable of performing useful functions economically, that it has already begun to find these broad bases of support. The inherent characteristic of the electronics art we call pervasiveness, that is, having the power to be present throughout all parts of civilizations of the world. To say it another way, by electronics pervasiveness, we mean it must be the destiny of the electronics art to become widely diffused throughout our industrial and social structure. An obvious example of one pervasive electronic product is the radio. If you doubt its pervasiveness, try to get away from one. Think what the world would be today without radio. The next two truly pervasive products will be the electronic calculator and the electronic watch. Notice that we think of electronics as an art in both the older and newer senses of the word. In the older sense, electronics is a craft requiring extensive technical knowledge. In the newer sense, electronics is a medium which allows creative solutions to new problems outside the traditional electronics industry. It is this aspect of creativity in application that we stress by using the word art. And it is this creativity and broad new applications that all of us must stress if we are to make electronics pervasive. Now, pervasiveness sparks into two trails that lead to the new growth frontiers of electronics. We have named one of these trails primary pervasiveness to cover the many cases in which the semiconductor industry directly serves non-electronic industries through new electronic applications. It is the main area of new market growth, and that's why we call it primary. This form of pervasiveness has hardly scratched the surface, and yet we can name dozens of relatively new electronic systems that fit into this definition that are already in common use. Now, I won't misuse your time by trying to catalog the thousands of potential electronic products for the man in the street that will make up the primary pervasive market. They range from computer terminals in the home to electronic dog collars. Now, I'm sure each of you has dreamed these dreams just as I have. Our task is to convert these dreams into realities, useful, attractive, saleable realities. Today's semiconductor prices and up-to-date technology make countless new products economically feasible. The only barriers to the many exciting new developments are our own parochial imaginations. We insist in squandering our very best brain power on problems that already have cost-effective solutions. How many engineers are at work designing new products to replace existing products with only incremental improvements? For example, the four-track stereo. Now, this is very imaginative use of engineers. The ultimate will be a one track for each instrument in a full symphony orchestra. Now, seriously, do we need better TVs, radios, voltmeters, counters, computers at this moment? Perhaps we ought to reorder our priorities. The second trail to our other frontiers of electronic expansion we call secondary pervasiveness. This phase covers the many cases in which the traditional electronics industry expands by introducing new kinds of equipment into the traditional market served by the old line manufacturers. Now, my wonder is not that there have been so many new functions served by electronic equipment. As you can see, my wonder is, why have there been so few? Now, what are the barriers to pervasiveness? As late as the early 60s, we had to admit there were still four basic barriers to the pervasiveness of our society by electronics. But the integrated circuit industry during the past 5 years has virtually removed the barriers of cost and reliability. And the other two barriers are falling as medium-scale integration and large-scale integration, coupled with both bipolar and MOS technology, are simplifying and demystifying the electronics for the non-electronics manufacturer. The barrier we call mystery still walls off whole industries behind their mechanical curtains. Electronics has been painfully slow in pervading the automotive industry with anything but the radio and the tape players, plus a few other incidentals. And this is because so many of its managers have grown up in the tradition of other disciplines. They are mystified by electronics. And what they don't understand, they distrust. Now, this is what I mean by the mystery of electronics. But any bright high school boy in a garage alone with a mechanical clock and some tools, and in an hour, he'll tell you how it works. In 2 hours, he'll be suggesting improvements. Now, put the same boy in a shop along with a simple transistor radio and some test instruments for a week. Now, he may come out able to sing the top 40 song, but electronics will still be a mystery to him. Now, there are two obvious ways we can conquer the barrier of mystery. One is to mount a head-on attack and push the barriers down with a widespread educational campaign. The quicker way is to bypass the barrier by confining all the mystery within a black box so that the artists need only worry about creating solutions with electronic building blocks, rather than trying to become an electronics engineer or electronics technologist. This approach is essentially what brought about the revolution in the desktop calculator industry, the most rapid evolution of the one-chip calculator provides the most obvious recent example of the pervasive power of solid-state electronics. As recently as 1966, you couldn't buy an electronic calculator. By 1975, 90% of the calculators sold in the U.S. will be electronic calculators, and almost all of these will be built in the U.S. But that's another story. This evolution also serves to demonstrate how entirely new markets can be opened when the barriers of cost, reliability, complexity, and mystery have been conquered. In 1966, a typical calculator had a retail price for $1,495. The cost was high, of course, because of the large number of semiconductor packages involved and the cost of assembly labor. Assembly was complex, and only companies who understood the mystery of electronics would consider manufacturing calculators. But now consider the present situation. The cost of a single chip, the few other components, plus very little assembly labor permits a retail price already in just a little over $200, placing it within the reach of a vast consumer market. The complexity barrier has fallen because all of the complexity is in one package with a few dozen pins, and the mystery has been stripped away from the calculator manufacturer. The one-chip calculator exemplifies precisely the directions we must take in the design of circuits and systems. If the semiconductor industry is to enjoy the many benefits of the strong growth through the inherent pervasiveness of solid-state electronics, the mini computer will be followed by the microcomputer through the use of the same sophisticated single-chip solid-state technology, and the microcomputer could pervade at least the industrial market and begin pervasive penetration among the self-employed businessmen and merchants. Now, what is the first challenge? I think in the semiconductor industry, we face a twofold challenge. First challenge is to develop inherently pervasive products. On the face of it, this may sound like a motherhood statement, but let me explain. A 32,000-bit solid-state single-chip ROM with a 50-nanosecond cycle time will be a major technical breakthrough, but it may be too specialized to be inherently pervasive. It could be just eating its own market. Our technology is ahead of our problem-solution ability. Traditionally, it has been the role of the electronics engineer to provide better answers. But at this moment in our history, we need men who will search for and find new problems which electronics will provide solutions for. We need those rare and gifted individuals who will ask, "What is the problem?" rather than say, "Here is the solution," someone should find the problem. In the past, our industry has sought new markets for expansion by asking, "What can we do with the electronics we have?" Our question in the future must be, "What needs to be done that electronics can do?" If we are truly successful in creating an environment of pervasiveness for electronics during this decade, then I believe the electronics industry could realize its potential and be a $110 billion industry in the free world by 1980. We will be limited only by our faith and imagination. Our second challenge is to help non-electronic firms put these inherently pervasive innovations to work. This brings me back to my theme of mystery. You and I, who spend our lives in electronics, always find it difficult to communicate with scientists and engineers in other fields who consider electronics a mystery. I'm sure you've talked to leading authorities in other disciplines who have only the vaguest notion of the capabilities of electronics. And I'm sure, on the other hand, that they were bewildered about our limited understanding of their disciplines. The challenge is how to make them creative with our electronics. We must facilitate the application of electronics by non-electronics engineers or technicians. The kind of products I'm talking to are about are electronic functions that can be applied without the need to know how these functions are electronically accomplished. Today, with logic complexities of 1,200 gates per chip, this is relatively common. We have a wide range of linear integrated circuit functions available, and we are seeing the beginning of power integrated circuits. Many of the essential tools are already at hand, but non-electronics manufacturers will not be to pass through our door. We must carry our wires down to the paths of their doors or directly to the end user's doors. Now let's turn for a moment to the specific areas of semiconductor technology that need attention and better solutions. How will these increases in density be achieved? Better answers to these five problem areas in LSI development will supply the thrust that will soon make multi-thousand gate chips more available, both inexpensive and widely applicable. Geometry reductions must be achieved through improved optics and better image transfer. The application of electron beam imaging to reduced geometries is a must. Active devices must continue to be reduced in area through the variations in imaging and junction formation, isolation techniques, and ion implantation. Improved passive elements, currently being formed by high resistivity, diffuse resistance paths in both bipolar integrated circuits, should be achieved by accelerated application of ion implantation. Success in the three areas I've mentioned will increase the urgency of developing two-level interconnections of high producibility. And finally, improvements in circuit techniques must give us means for improving existing circuits. But much more important, they must allow us to define more truly functional devices that have no direct analog in the circuit form. If we can make the advances, we can safely conclude that the visions of many thousand circuits on inexpensive chips are not pipe dreams. They will be realistic extrapolations of trends that have been at work since the earliest days of integrated circuits. Now, what will these higher orders of functional density mean? I think they will affect a transition to more standard circuits, but of extremely high complexity. In the early days of integration, it was easy to characterize simple standard devices because they were so small that they had to be used in extremely large quantities. Today, densities in the order of 100 to 1,000 have largely demanded customization to utilize the chip's full area. But at densities exceeding perhaps 1,000 or 2,000 gates per chip, we can perform entire subsystems on one chip. With little need to interface these chips with others, it is entirely feasible to standardize LSI circuits. In fact, the day will come when complexity will no longer be of interest. Only the function performed will be important, since most of the cost of the circuits will be too low to matter. The question is how low is low? Now, my purpose has been to sound the alarm and awaken solid-state technologists to the need for the creation of markets outside the traditional electronics industry. However, to complete our picture of potential for semiconductors in 1980, we must not overlook the tremendous potential for further penetration into the traditional end equipment industry. The historical trend during the past decade has been toward an increasing share of end equipment value being represented by the semiconductor content of the equipment. Presently, semiconductors represent about 5% of the end equipment cost. Two major factors convince me that this share will grow by at least 7% in 1980. First, the largest individual segments of the industry are the computer and industrial segments, and these segments are already characterized by semiconductor content in the 7 to 10% range. And second, as semiconductors become capable of performing more and more functions, notably in display and memory, we can realistically predict at least a 7% penetration by semiconductors in 1980. Now, what do we anticipate will be the growth of the free world electronics and semiconductor markets during this decade? Let me establish a range. First, let's look at what we hope is the lower limit. The free world GNP, gross national product, has been forecast at 4,800 billion by 1980. If the electronics art has not proved to be pervasive, the traditional electronics industry will only enjoy about 1.7% of GNP, a market of 80 billion. And if semiconductors continue to represent only a 4% share of the electronics industry, we will see a semiconductor market of only $3.2 billion in 1980. We must not let that happen. So let's look on the brighter side and consider the upper potential. Once again, we start with the $4,800 billion GNP for the world, free world. But now, if you can take and we can make electronics truly pervasive, electronics could enjoy 2.3% of the GNP instead of only 1.7. And if we can make semiconductors pervasive, we could capture 7% of a 110 billion electronics market. Therefore, putting together all the opportunities that I have mentioned, I can foresee, if we all do our job and meet the challenges, a 7.7 billion worldwide semiconductor industry is possible in 1980. It's important that we dream of this 7.7 billion market. We do have the brains, talents, and resources to make the dream come true if we but commit them. In Alex McKenzie's fine article about David Sarnoff in the January 72 issue of IEEE Spectrum, Ed Herod is quoted as having said, "A necessary part of Sarnoff's self-fulfilling prophecies mystique was that he had sufficient power to cause to happen what he predicted." In much the same way, we in the semiconductor industry can create technology enough to make reality of what we have courage enough to dream. Thank you.
Great deal of pleasure to introduce John Welty, Vice President, Assistant General Manager of the Semiconductor Division, to Motorola.
Thank you, Dick. Fred, I think, has indeed well set the stage for our discussion. In order to give you a picture of what we think is happening today and what we expect is going to happen in the next few years, I'd like to start with a review of some of the major occurrences of the past 2 years. 1970 was, without doubt, the most difficult year. It was a year marked by steadily declining business through each successive quarter. As a result of the bleak economic picture, it was a year of massive personnel cutbacks, belt tightenings, and virtual closing of the doors by some pretty significant companies in our industry. For the full year, sales fell by about 10%. More important than that, however, is the fact that the difference in the run rate between the high point of 1969 and the low point of 1970 was a whopping 30%. Stock analysts and financial men in general insist that we characterize years, or that we pause every year and characterize a year. But all of you who are involved in the day-to-day activities of a business know that you can't stop and place things into neat pigeonholes. There is a run rate. There is the temperature of the business right now. Consequently, it seems to me it is much more important in determining what's going on in the industry to look at what has happened to run rates. Because, for example, we characterize 1970 as $900 billion or a number like this. But it turns out that the only time during 1970 when the industry was operating at a $900 million rate was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on the 1st of July. It was either higher than that or lower than that most of the year. However, it goes down in history and we chart it as being a 900 million kind of year. As we started 1971, the trend began to reverse, business began to improve. Each quarter of 71 was better than the one that preceded it, until our business curve rather resembled a mirror image of the year before. Since we had started from a very low point in January of 71, industry sales were down about 5.5% from the 70 level, in spite of the fact that the fourth quarter run rate was significantly higher than the fourth quarter run rate in 1970. Now, what are we predicting for 72? Well, we expect 1972 to be a good growth year for the industry. We are looking for a growth of about 7% and an industry total of about $1,132,000,000. This will bring the industry back to the 70 level of sales, but will also be a continuation of the pattern of growth that we became so accustomed to in this volatile industry. Now let's take a look at some specific areas and markets to see what part we predict them to play in this growth pattern. The first area to show any signs of significant recovery during 1971 was the consumer market. It had dropped steadily from 1968's 4.6 billion U.S. factory sales to 1970's 3.5. During 71, it grew back to 4.1 billion. This resulted in a shot in the arm to the semiconductor industry on the one hand, but it also affected the average selling price of semiconductors on the other. What we started to see was a shift in the product mix to the higher volume, lower priced plastic encapsulated devices. This meant that many more millions of devices had to be shipped in order to maintain the same dollar sales volume. Meanwhile, during 71, the computer and industrial markets remained relatively flat, while the aerospace military markets declined significantly. In 72, we expect the computer market to resume its growth, and we are predicting that the U.S. electronics industry factory sales will be approximately $4.5 billion. With the industrial market also growing, but not quite so rapidly, to $3.1 billion. The federal markets will again remain relatively flat. As we look at these domestic markets, we should not entirely ignore the international marketplace. In fact, we shouldn't ignore it at all, because the free world markets are expected to grow even more rapidly than the U.S. markets once they overcome the current economic perturbations.
You have come to the end of Side 1 of this edition of IEEE Soundings. Our discussion of the technological and economic future of the solid-state industry, as well as a question-and-answer session with the audience at the Solid State Circuits Conference, continues on the other side. To continue, simply stop the machine and turn over the cassette to Side 2.